Welcome to Sci-Fi On Screen. I'm your host, Jeff Palermo, and this is episode number 6, Original versus Remake. And we're going to be comparing War of the Worlds, 1953 film, with the Steven Spielberg War of the Worlds, 2005 film. And this is a slightly different format tonight than just the one film, so this will be sort of trying to compare the two films in a lot of different ways, a lot of different areas. I want to start with some background. War of the Worlds is a time-hallowed sci-fi intellectual property, as they say these days. It was published by H.G. Wells, and it started serialization in 1897. So chapters were coming out in publications weeks at a time or months at a time. And then novelized in 1898. From what I can tell, generally favorable reviews of the time. The significant significant productions, I guess, of War of the Worlds, I should say, since they're not all visual. The first one was in 1938, and it was actually a radio drama, early podcast, if you will. Orson Welles in the Mercury Theater put it on. And Welles, back then, this was pre-Citizen Kane, so he was running around with the Mercury Players, and they were doing plays on Broadway, and I believe they were a company, and they did radio dramas. They wrote a version of War of the Worlds, it was sort of from the point of view of a news announcer. It was pretty much narrating the whole thing. And it was done, that particular episode, I believe, had no sponsors, so there was no commercial interruptions. It caused a bit of a stir. So, there had been some militarization in Europe. Hitler was clamoring and threatening to break loose into World War II. Supposedly, there was, this is kind of a funny side story, that there was a competing show on at the same time called The Chase and Sanborn Hour. It kind of sounds like kind of the SNL of its day, kind of a variety show. There's comedy sketches and intro stand-up and that sort of thing. They knew over at Mercury that maybe a lot of people in SNL, right, when you get to the news, you kind of maybe you check out or you switch to another channel, that they knew 12 minutes in was the big comedy sketch was over and a lot of people switched over to Mercury or to other channels. So they kind of designed the show, so when this happened, they'd be right in the middle of this, what sounded like a news broadcast. It seemed like a lot of people freaked out. There may be some government agencies involved. And for a short period of time, some of the population listening to this show, I guess you'd have to ask them, sort of believe that this was possibly happening in a little town in New Jersey. Just an interesting sidebar, kind of the first production of this book. And then in 1953, you had the George Pal-produced War of the Worlds film, which was for its time, a big sci-fi film. And in 1980, you had a TV show, which purported to be the sequel to that film. And the premise of this show, I think it was like a joint Canadian-US thing, was that the aliens had been preserved somehow, maybe some dead, maybe some alive, but we had kept the aliens alive through the decades. And now there was this conspiracy and they were going to get out, sort of pre-X-Files. And, you wonder if Chris Carter had watched it and, with his other inspirations. The next, obviously, the biggest one that we know about is production. Was Spielberg's in 2005. I'm going to compare the two films, the 1953 George Pal-produced version and the Spielberg and Cruise version. And I think what I'm going to do is try to compare them in certain areas. I'm going to start off by comparing, I'm going to flip back and forth between the films as I go through this podcast. And I'll go through the both films, but piecemeal, and kind of putting them together when they share certain attributes or even scenes. So I'm going to start off talking about the characters and how they're introduced, kind of the world before the alien contact, and the type of people we're talking about, and the tone of each film, and then obviously the reveal of the aliens in first contact, and then what I like to call flight from that first contact, what the characters do after the initial contact with the aliens, and the films diverge at this point significantly for a time. Then I'm going to talk about the scenes in certain films that were not in the other. There are both films have certain scenes that are not in the other film. And then obviously the endings of the film. So let's start up with the openings of both films. The 1953 film opens with a newsreel, covers the phases of sort of human mechanized warfare, begins in World War I, goes through World War II, and obviously covers, the advent of atomic weapons. In the World War I newsreel footage, we see a very old World War I tank. I couldn't help think that shot was in the newsreel footage as an homage to Welles, who had written a story called The Land Ironclads. And a lot of people think that he maybe has presaged tanks and perhaps put the idea of a tank into the minds of people who would eventually invent the thing. But he describes tank warfare in his story. I don't remember exactly when The Land Ironclads was released, but I don't know. It made me think that perhaps that was done for that reason. And then we're into credits, and we have Sir Cedric Hardwicke reading the voiceover from Welles' novel, and this is definitely about Martians. So first, Mars is mentioned, and we see this sort of fantastic Marscape with actual canals and cities. The notion here is that the Martians are on a dying planet. The narrator is telling us that they needed to find a new home. And so we're then treated to a tour of the solar system. And the narrator is telling us about how Neptune and Pluto are too cold and Mercury is too close to the sun, why they couldn't live, on each planet. There's a depiction of Jupiter, incredibly incorrect, showing mountains and valleys. And Jupiter is a gas giant. I don't think there are any solid objects, although they do suspect that there could be a giant diamond at the core of Jupiter because of the incredible pressures involved. And one sidebar to this, most of the tour through the solar system is done by looking at matte paintings, and they were painted by a guy named Chesley Bonestell, who, if you are a fan of sort of Golden Age sci-fi and the pulp era, this is a guy who did covers of Galaxy and Astounding Stories. And if you Google Chesley Bonestell, or Bonestall, probably I'm pronouncing his name incorrectly, you'll see these photographs, and you immediately know who I'm talking about, and you've seen these as a sci-fi fan. So now we flip to the remake, 2005 Spielberg, and we open with Morgan Freeman narrating, very similar to the original film from Welles' novel. And right away on the screen, we see bacteria, which we know if we've read the novel or we've seen the original movie, this is the ultimate slayer of the aliens by the end of the film. Freeman is narrating the bacteria we iris out becomes a drop of water. The drop of water turns into a scene from Space of the Earth, which then turns red briefly and then morphs into a red stoplight, and we're looking at a street scene. And I have to believe that that's the filmmakers giving a brief wink and a nod to fans of the original novel, because there is no Martian quotient in this new film. It is, they are aliens and we don't know where they're from. So I thought that was kind of a clever move on their part. During the narration, we're seeing a lot of scenes of Earth and civilization and towns and cities and farms and the notion that we're going about our business completely unaware that plans are being drawn against us. It's a great, spooky, very ominous beginning. Just a brief comparison of the two. The original, already we're getting a sense of where these two movies are headed and what they're about and how different they are. Besides being, over half a century apart, the original already was very science-based, and it sought to entertain its audience with actual science. Most of it was pretty correct, some of it was not, but using terms like solar system and talking about actual planets and giving us a brief tour, they sought to dazzle the audience with real science, which is very refreshing here in 2014. And the remake sought to set a very ominous tone, much more of needing to set a dangerous tone. Slightly different, more sinister choice of Welles' original narration. There are parts of it that did not make the original movie that made the remake that were a little more chilling in terms of drawing plans against us, so on and so forth. So now we have the character introductions. We're going to start with the 1953 film. We meet our protagonist as he's sitting with a bunch of his buddies around a picnic table, having an evening dinner out. I guess they're camping, it looks like. We're introduced to Clayton Forrester, who is the protagonist of the 53 film. He is an atomic scientist. We come to understand that he has worked on the Manhattan Project. Also, if you are someone who has seen The Thing from Another World, a sci-fi film that was released in and around this time as well, which I'm going to cover in a future podcast because I think it's a terrific film, a character from The Thing from Another World is one of the scientists sitting around with Clayton. His name is Robert Cornthwaite. I'm sure I'm butchering his name. So a little sidebar there. Clayton is an atomic scientist. He owns and can actually pilot his own airplane. That's it. No backstories, no other introductions. We're introduced to scientists. Through some of the plot, Clayton arrives at the crash site, and I'll get to that in a little bit, but the alien sphere has cylinder has crashed, and the townspeople are out. So we start seeing some of the townsfolk that are out witnessing this. They're talking like probably townsfolk, time immemorial. Nobody has a lot of money. Something spectacular has happened in their town. How can we make a couple of bucks from it? Talking about, I'll serve lemonade, and so-and-so will bring chairs, and kind of interesting. Clayton, our main character, meets a woman named Sylvia Van Buren, played by actress Anne Robinson. We meet her. She is a scientist groupie. There's a brief kind of play here where she's waiting, for Clayton Forrester. And of course, Clayton says, oh, really? Because she's never met him. And so he lets her kind of go on a bit about this guy. So it turns out that she's an atomic scientist groupie, ladies and gentlemen, has heard of Forrester. And not only that, has done a paper on him and his work when she was earning her master's degree. And now she teaches library science at USC. This is awesome. We're introduced to a female character. Anne Robinson is an attractive woman, but the first thing we get to know about Anne Robinson is her brain and what she's interested in. And it's awesome. I wish characters like this would pop up more in modern Hollywood films. It's kind of refreshing. We're briefly introduced to someone that Sylvia knows, sort of a mentor, who's a pastor. And the religious aspect is introduced very quickly in the original film. There's a pastor right in the mix from the beginning who sort of knows Sylvia, and somehow they're friends. Here we are, the characters introduced in the original film, very educated folks. Even the pastor is just a very decent guy. He's not, I'm afraid that if religious figures get depicted in popular films today in a way that would be somewhat extreme. Let's just put it that way. And this guy's the town pastor, and he seems like a decent folk. Those are the characters in the original film. And now we have the characters in the remake. Tom Cruise's character's name is Ray Ferrier. I don't know. I like to speculate about names. He will be obviously ferrying his children from one location to the other with the aliens in hot pursuit for the whole film. Other than that, I have no idea why his name's Ferrier. So he is a crane operator and a dock worker, and basically his job is to remove containers from container ships. And he's kind of a dick. He's got this hot car speeding around Bayonne, New Jersey, and it is Bayonne, New Jersey. It's amazing, amazing town they found to film this in. He screeches home, he's late, and his ex-wife and her husband, his two kids, being dropped off because they're going away. And of course, he's late. And from between the byplay of the characters, you realize he's kind of a deadbeat dad. He's never on time. And his daughter is trying to get her bag out of the car. And she's very small. And she can't handle it. And the mother looks at Ray, and Ray's oblivious. And then the mother has to go help her. And it's like, Ray's bad. He doesn't know how to, be a good dad. He's kind of a shlomo. They get in the house, and it's just all about their bickering and their terrible relationship. Ray and his son are contentious. The son's sort of a teenager, thinks his father's a dick. He's a slouch. The daughter is long-suffering. She's the most mature one, but they're just bickering around. So what we know about this family is that there's been a schism in the past. Ray's turned out to be a real slacker. The kids don't like him, and frankly, nobody really likes these three kids. Dakota Fanning is extremely charming, but she's a little precious. The actor playing Tom Cruise's son just seems kind of a dick, as many surly teenage boys do. What's interesting to me is to compare the two. The original film presented some very highly educated people, two scientists. So those are going to be our two main characters, these extremely educated people who value science and reason. The main character has his own plane. He's a pilot. And in the remake, we have these kind of annoying, dickish people, working class people, and I am working class people, so I don't see that as a slight. With no education, and there are children present in the new one, because I'll get into that later. And the interesting thing is, in the original, the dialogue is mostly about the problem at hand. Sylvia is asking Clayton, "What do you think, Doctor? What do you think this could be?" And Clayton's talking about, well, if it was, it should have made more of a crater. So I hypothesized that it's maybe hollow inside. So their dialogue is sort of about what's going on. The dialogue of the remake is just about playing up the broken relationships between these three characters. They're just bickering and bickering and bickering and bickering and talking about things that are completely unrelated to the story. Part of my theory here is that, 1953, we haven't gotten to... I feel like we've gotten to sort of an exhaustion level in terms of dramatic character tropes in films. We just can't do story anymore without it being, I don't know, either really hyper stylized or fractured in a way. You know, dramatic straight line storytelling, you know, who does it now? Comic book movies really do it, and it's as fake with them as anybody else. But in 1953, they were still like, okay, we have characters. Characters could just be characters. They didn't have to have backstories. They didn't have to add to the tension of the plot, which is kind of what Spielberg will get to as these things go on. He does an overkill of everything on the screen is meant to sort of jar you and make you uncomfortable. In 53, they were like, we can relax and we're going to tell a story because we think you'll be interested about the aliens landing and what this could mean. And, you know, you can breathe in between big action scenes and you can kind of come along with us and we don't have to get at you every second. So now the next sequence of the films, which I want to compare, is the aliens, obviously. The arrival of the aliens and first contact. And we'll start with the 1953 film. Right when the film starts, we get right into the action. The film opens on Earth and we see a fireball in the sky. We cut to several scenes of townsfolk in a small town who witness this large fireball dropping out of the sky. They wind up, you know, rushing to the scene and put out the fire. And we see this large glowing rock. And we have obviously no idea what it is, what it's doing there. And that's when we cut back and we're introduced to Clayton. Clayton is there. Sylvia is there. Forrester has brought a Geiger counter. You know, we're very science related here, and especially atomic science, being that we're in 1953 when atomic science was like a big deal. From the Geiger counter, we see that the meteor is actually radioactive. Their curiosity has piqued, and we're in the midst of characters, real characters, making kind of reasonable deductions about what's going on. Clayton and Sylvia go to a town social. We have some locals who are kind of standing watch by the rock to see if anything happens, but everyone else has gone back into town. We cut back, we see Clayton and Sylvia dancing, and then we cut back to the three people watching, and we start to hear a sound of metal on rock. And then we see that a portion of the thing that has dropped is actually a little circular hatch, and it's beginning to turn. And it turns very slowly, and the suspense builds, and it's a really terrific shot. They take their time. The hatch falls off. And inside is this mysterious green and red light, and we hear a little sound effect. And what we see is a slender neck, which, you know, could be a goosenecked lamp, as it were, with this blinking red eye at its end. And there's this sort of rattlesnake sound effect, which is very good, actually. Of the three people left to watch, you know, there's two white dudes and a Mexican laborer, because we're in Los Angeles. I forgot to mention, actually, the setting. This is set in L.A., and the remake is set in Bayonne, New Jersey. And the Mexican laborer I like, he's the one guy who's like, the two other guys are like, oh, let's go see what it's like, and let's cut out a white flag and tell them that we're in. The Mexican laborer is like, I don't think that's a good idea, you know, the smart one. So the three observers approach the alien, waving this makeshift white flag, and then we have this really close-up shot of the eye of the alien and the metal neck that supports it. And it's facing us directly. And then it turns around to face the three men, and the camera's behind it, facing in the same direction. It's a really nice little directorial touch, and it's very menacing because we fear for these three guys big time. And of course, you know, the alien disintegrates them immediately in a flash of light, although it's a very dated sci-fi shot, you know, and it's a nice shot, and it's some nice sound effects, but it's very dated, nothing very visceral. You know, we're not really drawn in very much, but they're gone.
So our wonderful friends have been disintegrated, and we go back now to the social. And at the social, the lights have gone out in the town, and the phone is out, sort of like an EMP-type pulse, although they don't say the words electromagnetic pulse or EMP pulse. What they kind of find out, what the scientist kind of intuits, is that their watches have been magnetized. And there's a little brief demonstration of the scientist Clayton putting a needle next to his watch, and it flips to the watch. So again, we're dealing with some science again, magnetism. And they're looking out the window, and they see this huge fire. Clayton heads down towards the fire with some townsfolk. And then there's a really creepy shot of three men that were met their end. They're outlined on the ground in ash. It's really cool. For 1953, I think it was a pretty creepy shot. Then we see again the vacuum cleaner-like head and neck of this thing, this alien, come out of the hole in the cylinder. Cop freaks out and, you know, jumps in his car and runs away, and the alien destroys the car. And at that moment, they see another cylinder dropping down in the distance. So from there, the military is now in. And we're now with them, sort of, we're back at, like, you know, headquarters. There's a media commentator doing an interview. We get the scope of the invasion. We get a sense of that it's a global catastrophe. There's some cool speculation. The commentator is talking with Clayton, and he's asking Clayton, you know, what would these Martians look like? Clayton speculates scientifically, like with the air and the gravity of Earth, and if they are Martians, the difference in gravity. And again, we're back in scientific speculation. And we also are in the know. We're high up in the sort of the pecking order here in terms of what's going on. Scientists and you know, mayors and sort of heads of municipalities and that sort of thing. And we see and hear all the command decisions that are being made. An airplane's going to do a flyby. We see the neck emerge out of the cylinder again and destroys the plane. And then it also begins to attack the nearby military, and we see trucks, you know, completely disintegrating, and things are being destroyed. It's a bit of a skirmish, and now more tanks and trucks and firepower being brought in to the battle. And we see Sylvia bustling around with Danishes. You know, unfortunately, we are in pre-feminist times here, so, you know, as bright as she is, she's serving coffee. So then we hear something about the other areas of the world. You know, there's a quote, once they begin to move, no more news comes out of that area. And there's a quote we're going to hear in the remake as well. We hear reports of, you know, the heat ray and how destructive it is. You know, this has been some nice suspense, actually. Will the aliens move? Up till now, they've just been stationary. And what does it mean that, you know, once they move, no more news comes out of that area? So this film is sort of, you know, working the suspense angle a little bit. So then finally, the aliens emerge and begin to move. And for the first time, we see what their ships are going to be like. And they're this really cool manta ray shape. The top of it is still the sort of vacuum cleaner hose type thing that's coming out. It sort of reminded me of like a Cylon Raider with a vacuum cleaner attached to the top of it. And they look great. I mean, you know, even now, here in good old 2014, they still look very cool. They look very sleek. They look kind of like the way the future used to be advertised, you know, where cars had fins and it was going to be the Jetsons and everything. And there's still a sleek little kind of futuristic look to them, even now. And we get a sense that there's some kind of repulsor field underneath that's supporting it, that they levitate by magnetism, which continues our, you know, science theme, that magnetism is a big part of, you know, what these creatures are. And now you have this, our brave pastor of the town, thinking about, well, no one's actually even tried to communicate with these beings, you know, maybe they think we want to do them harm. And he's sort of the pacifist of the group, says goodbye to Sylvia, of course, gives Sylvia his blessing to, like, you know, you can, if you hook up with Clayton, I'd be very happy. And then we see another manta ray machine rise up, so we've got two now. He walks out towards them reading Psalm 23, which is, you know, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, so on and so forth. And he's killed, and Sylvia kind of freaks out, and the military retaliates with everything they have, but there's no effect. And then a third machine now emerges. Cool thing is, as we see the sort of the military's hardware hitting the machines, it kind of outlines the cone force field effect, which is very cool. And again, echoed in the remake when it's done. And now the aliens kind of just open up fully. So they shoot these beams from sort of the vacuum cleaner necks, but they also shoot them from the wingtips of the manta ray body of the ship. And they're just destroying everything. I mean, nothing can stand in their way. And there's this one moment where, you know, there's a shot of the three ships just opening up on everything. And it's cool. You know, it's very cool. It's like alien tech gone amok. And then some shots of the bunker where our heroes and, you know, the main military guys are, some stuntmen running around on fire, which probably was a big deal back then. And then at some last moment, the general gets incinerated, and Clayton and Sylvia basically bail, and his plane is nearby, and they jump in and they head off. And so I'm going to stop there, move on over to the 2005 remake. The way this film works is that you're still centrally focused on the characters and their crappy relationships and all of that bickering. You get little hints and moments of what's to come. During some of their bickering, you see one of them watching a news channel, and there's this news report of lightning storms in the Ukraine, that EMP pulses have been sort of recorded in the area, as well as seismic disturbances, right? But the film itself is still focused on the characters and their bickering. But of course, you know, if you're a sci-fi fan, you're picking that up huge. So a couple of quick things happen here. We get some wonderful shots of the Bayonne Bridge since they filmed this. Bayonne, New Jersey. It's a real sense of place. I mean, you're really in Bayonne. you know, you're really seeing the backyard shots. And, you know, they chose a house and areas to use, which are right by the bridge. And it's just the whole thing has scope and a very powerful sense of place. There's a small moment here where the daughter has a splinter. Ray wants to get it out. And she says, no, Daddy, you know, when it's ready, my body will just push it out. And this is definitely an allusion to the alien invasion. You know, at a certain point when the Earth is ready, it will just push the aliens out in terms of the bacteria infection that will, you know, knock them down. So clever little foreshadowing. So then you get the beginnings of some of the great visuals in this film. While Ray was sleeping, because he works the day shift, so he's, you know, oh, sorry, he works the night shift, so he sleeps during the day. Robbie steals his car, so it's a pretext for Ray to get out of the house. And when he runs out, there's this incredibly wild-looking black cloud formation above the city. And in the middle of it, you know, is this emptiness. You don't know what's there. And Ray runs back into the backyard. He grabs his daughter, and there's this incredible windstorm. It's very ominous, you know, because everyone in the neighborhood sort of like looking at it as like, oh, this is really cool, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, we know that they're getting close to D-Day, as it were. There's this great moment. This is where Steven Spielberg, where he earns his pay every single time. They're standing in the backyard and they're kind of looking off past the Bayonne Bridge into the sky at the center of this black cloud mass. What Ray notices that the wind is blowing towards the storm, which I guess is unusual. I'm not a meteorologist, so I couldn't tell you. Then there's a moment when there the lightning strikes. The wind just dies. And the way the wind dies, the way you see it as a viewer, is all of the laundry. You have, there's a shot of all the backyards in this sort of Bayonne housing block. A lot of parts of cities that aren't like in the main city, you know, like if in New York, talk about Brooklyn or Queens, you know, or New Jersey, which is where they are. You know, you have houses sort of stacked against each other. And if you go out into the backyard, like all the backyards are like right next to each other and everybody can see everybody. So the camera is playing this up. It's shooting from above and across and you see all the backyards and the Bayonne Bridge right there. It's a great, great shot. You know, he has laundry up on every house. So when the wind dies, the camera comes a little closer and you see all of the like sheets and things that are hanging on the line in unison slowly float back down to the vertical. And it's the man, you know, he'll do this so many times in the film. I'll probably cover every single one because I think this is part of why he's such a successful filmmaker. So the lightning strikes now start to happen. They're pretty intense. The sound is great. We see them a little bit, but he's part of his MO in this film is everything is sort of off camera, briefly off screen. You know, nothing's really in the frame for very long with him. There's a joke about, you know, if lightning struck in one place, it won't strike there again. But of course, the lightning is striking in the exact same place every time. And it's starting to freak people out. Ray's daughter is like, I wants to go inside. And, you know, her anxiety level with everything, obviously, is continually driving the annoyingness of the characters. Once the lightning strikes cease, there's a funny scene of them hiding under the table. But then everything's dead. Nothing works. You know, no phones, no anything. And you get a sense that it's sort of an EMP pulse-ish type of thing. Ray runs outside, and again, great shot. Everyone's out in the neighborhood, and the camera pans up. So you're getting a lot of this little street in Bayonne, and it looks really, you know, you're drawn in. It's very realistic. A lot of people are gathered, a lot of low-angle shots about what's going on. Eventually, you know, Ray walks towards the area where all these lightning strikes hit, and all of the townspeople kind of follow, and everyone congregates around this spot where the lightning strikes have hit. And they've punched a hole in the asphalt in the middle of the street. And Ray gets up really close, and he touches one of the pieces of asphalt that's been knocked off, and it's ice cold. And then we get a straight overhead shot as the street starts to crack, and the cracks are emanating from this central hole. And as the camera goes up, we see the cracks are widening, and the people in the circle around the hole are backing up. Like, it's very dramatic. It's really great. They back off to a certain degree. And then all of a sudden, there's a really large rumbling, you know, like a 50 or 60 foot circular area begins to turn. Like in the original film, you had the top unscrewing from the cylinder. Now you have a huge circular top unscrewing from the ground itself. It's there are some buildings within this diameter. And it's this killer shot as the facade of a church actually rotates away from itself as part of the part that's spinning where the rest of the church is on the part that's not spinning. And it's cool, man. It is cool. There's a great shot coming through the church, the light, and the steeple falls, and all of a sudden, you know, there's this giant sinkhole that forms, and people start to run. It's an amazing buildup. I mean, it's, you're so in this movie at this point. It's kind of a joke. And then all of a sudden, a car that had fallen in the sinkhole is thrown way up in the air, flips over, and falls down, upside down. And now begins the sequence which I like to call the Saving Private Ryan of sci-fi film. I cannot understate how amazing this sequence is that's about to come. And there's absolutely nothing in the first film that gets anywhere near this. Our first glimpse of a remake alien is a massive three-toed metal foot arcs out of the hole, which is all full of dust, and arcs down, destroying a car just in front of Ray. And then slowly the main body of the machine rises, and you hear this incredible rising sound of like turbines, as if a giant engine was slowly turning on, or like a giant, you know, I wonder if they got it from a jet engine, because it really sounds like a huge turbine. But the sound is incredible, and there's no complete visual yet. You know, we're only getting little chunks of this thing. There's a lot of dust, so you can't really see it completely. People are starting to really book away from it now. The John Williams score kicks in, very Jaws-like, you know, a lot of dun-dun-dun-dun, quick staccato strings. And this is, it's a powerful moment. The entire machine completely rises, and the camera backs way off, and we get a sense of this thing. It's the lights in the front completely rises. The camera now is about like a half a mile away, and we see how large the machine is. And we're sort of seeing most of Bayonne as the ship rises out of the dust cloud that it created. And it is awesome. Just, you know, standing on these three legs. It's like a giant tadpole with lights and three incredibly cool legs that it's sitting upon. It is unbelievable, man. I mean, it is an unbelievable sequence. And now we get a shot, a low angle shot in front of Ray, pointing up and sort of behind him. And through the smoke, the alien starts to kind of orient itself now. It's standing there fully erect. All of a sudden, it kind of stops. It doesn't do anything. And the crowds kind of stop, and Ray stops, and then they kind of come back out to look at it. They're not really sure what's going to happen next. It's really a good lull in the action. And then the alien kind of moves slightly up and down, you know, and it puffs some vapor out of itself. And then it emits this incredibly cool sound. It's like this wild foghorn. But it has a specific signature and a melody to it, and you hear it over and over again and as the film goes on. And I couldn't help think that this was like anti-Close Encounters, right? Because these aliens are not here to play nice. We get that rising whine of turbine sound. And these two arms slowly unfold from the machine. And again, it's that rising sound of the engine inside this machine that really is, you really get you, man. You really, you don't know what's going to happen, but you know it's building towards something. And then we see the alien reflected in a car windshield and Ray standing right next to it. And then the attack. So out of the limbs comes these disintegrator rays. But we start to see this first through the view screen of a dropped camcorder, which is just awesome. It's the first shot and we see these rays come down and they're just completely disintegrating people. And we see their clothing blowing away empty and the dust and the ashes of what they were also starting to float up now and fill the air. And now the camera is at a very low angle, as if it's being carried by a fleeting pedestrian, but looking behind. And we just watch as the death ray just starts killing people, dozens and dozens of people. It's wiping them out by the dozens. And our camera is at this low angle. So we're seeing the killing of these people, and we're seeing the alien behind it and above it. It's awesome. And the air is starting to fill up with their remains, which is just incredibly creepy, and it's very intense. And then in a very chilling moment, a woman running right in front of Ray is vaporized, and he runs into her remains. And it happens a bunch of times, actually, and Ray ultimately becomes covered in other people's sort of ashes. And it starts to escalate. Entire houses are destroyed, kind of blown out right behind Ray that are running. It's very visceral. It's a nail-biter of a sequence. I've never seen anything like this before in sci-fi films, and it is so tactile and powerful. It's quite, quite extraordinary. So Ray kind of runs out of the path of this walker and hides behind a house and kind of peeks behind, and we see this walker stride away into this cloud of smoke, and the emergence scene ends. And this has been some scene. I mean, I behoove you, if you can find a copy, I don't know if you can find it on YouTube, but just to watch this sequence. I mean, even if you don't want to watch the movie, rewatch the sequence because it is a stunner. It is a stunner and one of the best filmed sci-fi action sequences ever done, frankly. And the only niggling thought I had, because, you know, this is what I do, I really appreciated the genius of the vehicles being in the ground. And at the same time, I thought it's ridiculous, completely ridiculous. You know, that thousands of these things are going to be buried right underneath our feet, that we would have never scanned them with all of the drilling and surveying that we do, and, you know, all the oil that we dig for, and how much we've looked underground at so many things that no one's ever come across one of these vehicles before. And I guess maybe some argument is that it's so far down that, you know, we can't get that far down. You know, you can make a lot of arguments, but there was something about it that just rang really false. You have to take your medicine with your sugar, and this is by far a very small nit to pick. Comparison between the alien emergences between the first film and the remake. And the original film took its time. There was a gentle suspense. The aliens really, they had discovered the aliens, and the aliens didn't move for a while, which, you know, there was a slow buildup, and we got lots of talking about what's going to happen. The military came, and there was a really classic way of building suspense, which was great. You know, by the time we finally saw the things emerge, the timing was just about right. We were ready. And the aliens were great looking. You know, the manta ray shapes and the conical shielding, and they moved very slowly, and they were kind of creepy in their own way. And the sound effects were cool for its time. And this rattlesnake effect and these other effects, I mean, very, very effective. Spielberg gets into the action much quicker. He's never one to really wait very long to show the audience what he's got under the hood. And I think here what, you know, the remake has on its side is simply the power of modern filmmaking and the tactile details that it can throw at a viewer. I mean, the original, in a way, needed the longer buildup, because the physical presence of the aliens, while amazing, you're still somewhat detached from these three manta rays kind of floating around. But Spielberg doesn't need that, because he's going to go for complete immersion and verisimilitude for his audience. You know, one of the main differences here is in this shot, very much. The level of tactile detail in everything in the remake. The unfolding of the aliens, the crashing of the car, the sounds, the Foley work, the shots in the windshield, the camcorder, the window of the shop reflections. I mean, this is a modern movie. There are so many sonic aspects and, you know, glass crunches. Like, things are just so much more tactily present in this film that it's the power of modern filmmaking. And in genre film, which relies a lot on showing us and trying to make us feel something as real as possible, even though it's a fantastic idea, he has that power behind him, the years and years of filmmaking. It's a richer experience overall because you're just so much further involved. And the score also, the John Williams, really just... I'm going to switch to what I consider the flight from First Contact. We'll get back to the 1953 film. We're in a plane flying with Clayton and Sylvia, and they see military jets approaching from the opposite direction. They're attacking some of the aliens, and Clayton nearly runs into one of the flying aliens. The camera's sort of situated as if it's on the top of his plane. It's kind of cool. And unfortunately, since avoiding the aliens, the plane crashes. They kind of hide in the wreckage as the aliens pass over. And then we cut to a street scene in Los Angeles, and some really nice, really good shots of downtown of 1953 Los Angeles. One of the generals has arrived who was not killed in the initial attack, and he's being mobbed by reporters, and they meet with all the heads of the city, and they're having this big discussion about we're going to evacuate, and because the aliens are sort of 20 to 30 miles outside Los Angeles, and they're closing. Then the general learns that sort of Clayton has disappeared. You know, he didn't make it out. And I'm going to stop there because the next sequence in the original film is one where there's a very similar sequence in the remake. The remake just takes a lot longer sort of to get there, but I kind of want to get there together and then move forward. Now I'm going to flip to the remake, and we have Ray returning home after that incredible scene. There's no way he can really explain what he's seen to his children. At one point, the kids are just pummeling him. What happened? What happened? He has no way to discuss or say what it is that's going on. And in this really great moment, his daughter notices that he's covered in dust, and he sort of snaps back into focus and realizes that what's on him you know, or the ashes of people. And he freaks out and runs into the bathroom. And what they try to do here, which is kind of nice, you know, Ray doesn't come home and start yelling at the kids saying, aliens have landed, we're being invaded by, you know, creatures from space or, you know, monsters from space, and we've got to hurry up and get out of here. He literally cannot express what he has just experienced. And that, it's pretty cool. Problem is, they take this to such an extreme in this film. No questions are ever answered. Nothing is ever said. They keep screaming at him about what happened, and he won't answer. Again, it's more conflict, and they're yelling at each other, and the kids are trying to pull out of him where these creatures are from, or where the attacking force is from. There's a funny little line where Ray's like, they're not from around here. And his son's like, well, where are they from, Europe? And Ray's like, they're a little further off. What's happening now is they're piling themselves in the car and getting out of there is that, you know, his daughter is just completely having a panic attack and she's freaking out. And so they have to contain her. Robbie's screaming at him to tell him what's going on. Ray won't tell them. I know they're trying to keep this thing in a human level, but I'm just fucking annoyed. I'm just annoyed. There's something about it that just rings false. That there's something about where I feel like this is just being used to agitate me, and I'll get to that later on. They're on their way out. They grab a car, and there's this incredible sequence where the aliens take out the Bayonne Bridge. It is large in the screen, and the camera sort of panning across it as the whole bridge is just upended and fragmented. I mean, it is an awesome scene and a great sort of last ending scene for sort of the initial contact with the aliens. So now they're rushing down a freeway littered with dead cars. Rachel's freaking out. The brother's trying to calm her down. And again, Ray's not answering them. And so, you know, this creates tension for us. And they decide to head for his ex-wife's house. And they get there, but the ex-wife and the husband have left for Boston. And the neighborhood is pristine. You know, the aliens haven't gotten there yet. The bickering of the family continues, and they take refuge in the basement. That night, we hear some incredible sounds, and a lot of stuff's going on outside the house. And they hide in the basement, and we see lights, and we hear all kinds of things coming from outside the house. And we have no idea what's going on. And light streaming in the basement kind of reminded me of some E.T. effects, which were really cool. What's part of his visual theme here is that so much that goes on in this movie is unseen and away from the screen. The next morning when Ray wakes up, he emerges into this scene of destruction that the neighborhood's been completely demolished. And it's a masterful sequence. Basically, we follow Ray walking up the steps of the basement. And when he comes to the top of the steps, you know, the camera's shooting at him like he's still in the house. But then we see that his hair is sort of blown by a little breeze. And it's a very uncanny moment, which Spielberg does so incredibly well. A little detail, and it throws us, like, well, why is there wind blowing in his hair if he's in the house? And the camera continues to pan with him. And then slowly, as he's walking sort of to camera right, the camera tracks past a huge engine of an airliner in the living room. And it's an awesome scene, and it's on fire. And then past the engine, Ray stumbles outside into the neighborhood, and there's nothing standing. And he walks past the carcass of a huge nose of an airliner on its side. Again, it's an amazing scene, and it's scorched. We see this huge landing gear in the foreground. The tail section is back in the distance. As the camera sort of pans up and back, the entire neighborhood has been demolished. It is an amazing scene, an amazing art direction for this shot. Like, literally every patch of spare ground is either a destroyed building or something that's been thrown or obliterated. And the camera just takes its time, pans up, and we get to take it all in. It really puts us in the scene very powerfully. We're looking at a low angle shot behind Ray up at the passenger section of the aircraft. It's basically the whole cabin around the seats has been ripped away, and it's just the seats are left. And we see some man dragging, you know, one of those beverage carts that they wheel down the center of the plane, you know, when you fly. And he's trying to get it down, and the whole thing is tilted, you know, so he's barely hanging on up there. We continue with our motif of characters not answering each other's questions. He's shouting questions to the guy, and the guy's not even listening. Then out of nowhere, we see a woman in a news van, and they're reporters basically scavenging for food. This reporter gives an aside that the man getting the food from the airline is deaf, so he couldn't hear him. Okay, fine, there's a reason. And now we get a little exposition, and this kind of harkens back to in the earlier film when we cut to the newscaster talking about what was going on in the rest of the world. This is the same kind of moment in the new film. And we hear from this woman, basically, that the National Guard has had very little luck against the machines. because of their shielding. And there's this great moment where Ray's like, there's more than one? This woman's like, are you crazy? And she takes him into her van. She starts showing him video footage that she's taken from all over the world. And we see aliens on the screen, this little TV camera, walking through full-on cities. And it's a chilling scene. We kind of confirm Ray's speculation as well. Ray speculated in the van as they were speeding away that it seemed like, you know, they came down into the machines. And I'm not really sure how the hell Ray got that idea. In a really cool sequence, the reporter slows down the video she's showing him. And we see these little ships that kind of rode the lightning into these cracks in the pavement. And I guess from somewhere up, they came down and, you know, into the machines. So now we hear the sound of a machine in the distance. The reporters all freak out and they leave. It's kind of a cold moment where they're all in the van and she asks him a question. He answers it and they just shut the door and leave him without even a thought. And then the farriers all get in their car and sort of head out. They're driving through part of the countryside where there's no people. There's one really cool sequence where Rachel has to go to the bathroom because, you know, her job is to drive the anxiety level of all of us. Of course, she doesn't want to be seen by her father, so she runs down by the river. But before she can go, she sees a body floating in the river and she walks closer. And then all of a sudden, the river fills up with like dozens and dozens of bodies and they just keep coming. And it's creepy and really cool. So after the cool river sequence, we have a scene where the National Guard is on their way towards the aliens or some front to fight them. The car has stopped and Robbie runs to try to join the National Guard and the guard don't pick him up from the trucks. His father is chasing him. Robbie, don't. What are you doing? He has to hold him back. There's a John Williams score telling us that this is an important, you know, and gravitic moment between family members. But, you know, it's nonsense. And we all know it's nonsense. None of it's real. There's no relationship here that in any sense matters other than to annoy us. Then we get a scene where they're on their way to some ferry. So the idea is that they're going to cross some river and get to the other side and head towards Boston, where Ray's ex-wife is. And, you know, basically the whole plot of this movie is for Ray to bring his kids to his ex-wife. You know, like the aliens have not invaded his ex-wife's house because, you know, she's superpowered or something. I don't understand any of it, frankly. So they get close to the ferry and it starts to rain. There's a lot of people around and, of course, they all want the car. And they start smashing the car. And it's Spielberg City. You know, they're inside the car. A lot of people want the car. There's a lot of tension. The car is stopped. A gun is pulled. Shots are fired. The kids are threatened. Basically, at the end of all this, Ray and his children are sitting in the diner. The car has been stolen. Basically, a retread of a scene that I haven't gotten to yet in the original film, where the protagonist loses a truck that he was driving, but it makes sense in that film. They get on the ferry. The ferry scene, and I believe there was a ferry scene in the novel. I believe they're following the novel closely in this way. They walk by what I call the 9/11 wall. And I'll pause for a minute now to kind of talk a little bit about the parallels in this film. You know, this film was definitely made post 9/11. One of the first powerful metaphors that is in the film is that early on, Ray is covered with the ashes of dead civilians that the alien has vaporized. If you remember, so many shots of civilians running away from the World Trade Center on 9/11, they were covered with dust. I think this is a very clever homage to what happened and a literal interpretation that, well, they were covered with dust from 9/11. You know, Ray's covered literally with the dust of dead civilians. And it's very clever. And I think it's respectful as well. So now they're walking past this wall, which is very much like the 9/11 wall, pictures of loved ones, people are carrying posters of loved ones, and it's a wonderful scene. And then they get to a train crossing, and the bell sounds, and the bar goes down. This train comes rushing by completely on fire. I mean, very much a companion to the scene where Rachel is standing in front of the river watching the dead bodies go by. This is just another scene, and it's just out of nowhere. And it's uncanny and Spielbergian, you know, wonderfulness. Now it's nighttime. There's lots of lights on. The ferry's being loaded. We hear this Tony Bennett song playing on the loudspeakers, trying to keep people calm. Ray bumps into a woman and her children from the old Bayonne neighborhood, which basically she's there so later on there can be some fake gravity and tension when she can't get on the ferry and, you know, we're all crying in our Diet Cokes because of it. So at this point in the film, the continual bickering and human drama are really beginning to gall, as you may have slightly suspected. I don't care what happens to Ray Ferrier, Rachel Ferrier, and his son. You know, personally, I kept wishing that one of them would die to give the film some gravitas and some tragedy. You know, I feel like he's using the children just like he used them in Jurassic Park, you know, as a medium to which to get to the audience. Brother, sister, very similar, and substitute the tripods for Tyrannosaurus Rex. But in Jurassic Park, we cared about Alan Grant. Alan Grant was a good guy. We liked Alan Grant. We liked Ellie. They were very likable characters. You know, Ian Malcolm was a scoundrel. We liked him anyway. We don't like anybody in this film. In the original film, I liked Clayton and Sylvia. I was rooting for them. They were nice people. And when Clayton's truck gets taken in the original, I do feel angry at the mob kind of destroying what might be the last chance to defeat the aliens. But in this film, I just feel that I'm being manipulated. The continual bickering of the family and Dakota Fanning being frightened of her own shadow and at the same time being a young adult with her father. I just feel manipulated. You know, in some ways, I feel like what's missing here, you know, he's using 9/11, you know, in metaphor. He's using, you know, he uses the wall. He's using the people. There was positive human drama on 9/11. There was so much positive human drama. So many people from so many disparate areas in life came together. There was no looting. There was very little collateral nastiness. But none of that makes it into the film. There's one scene later on that sort of gets at it, but because Spielberg, to me, is always at war with his own instincts, you know, he needs to use certain elements of film to create tension. He will usually fall back on tension-creating devices rather than, you know, the spirit or even a well-balanced film or a film that sticks to its theme in both sides. If that makes any sense. I kind of feel like I'm not making the most sense here, but hopefully this will come out as I continue. But ultimately, it's his quest for suspense. He will use any means he can to achieve it, and he will borrow and rob from any tragedy. And I don't mean that as that he's disrespectful about it, that he can't help being a guy who wants to make you jump out of your seat. And it continues to come back to him as much as he will use these august scenes, and he will try to bring you into like a 9/11 type of thing. I don't want to say it's not honest, but there's something about it that bothers me. Let's put it that way. In the next scene, we're back, and he's showing us why he is a master of the medium. The camera tracks above the heads of all these people flocking towards the ferry. And then we have a camera shot from a low angle from Rachel's point of view. She's looking at this flock of birds. She turns and sees the birds, and the camera follows her head and the birds as they fly over the flock of people who are completely oblivious to it. Then she turns around to find out why the birds are flying away, and we see these lights past the trees. Then the other two ferriers turn around and see it. Then the trees are moving. Then a single tripod appears, and only the ferriers can see it. It's a really great scene, and it bellows its wonderful sound. And then the camera cuts far back to another establishing shot. This shot is composed like a painting. The tripod is in the background, cresting this hill. And at the base of the hill is the ferry crossing and the ferry loading. And there are lights everywhere, bathing the scene in this eerie glow. It is fantastic and masterful, and he rests there for a moment, or a beat, I should say, which is nice because I want to drink in this scene. Then mass panic ensues, and of course, everyone is rushing towards the ferry. The ferry captain sees that, of course, if everyone tries to board the ferry, it's going to sink. So he casts off, but now the tension is that, you know, more people want to get on the ferry. A second tripod appears, then a third at the crest of the hill, shining lights down on these panicking people. The ferriers cannot get on. Ray finds a way around, you know, and they dump some cars in the river and they jump on. And of course, at some point, the wall of the carrier goes up, but the neighbor can't get on. And he's yelling for her to get on, but she can't. Suddenly, the ferry leaves. Then we have heroic Robbie running past everyone and running up on the gangplank, which has now been raised, and helping people over the wall. Robbie is a hero, and Ray, the happy father, is watching Robbie do this. Whatever. Now there is a tripod in the water and it's rising up, and it's this incredible scene as this huge tripod rises up right next to the ferry like some amazing leviathan. Attacks the ferry, basically capsizing it, and the ferriers are thrown in the water. And there's a wonderful scene where as people are going into the water, the camera's following them from above the water and then sinking into the water and bobbing back and forth. And you're seeing the frothing above the water and the bodies writhing below. There's this the huge spinning props of the ferry because it's been capsized. It's an amazing scene. And then there's a new element. The tripods, using dozens of tentacles, are picking people up out of the water, taking them and dumping them in these little baskets hanging from their main carriages. And we're looking at all this through the angle of someone being in the water. And they just look like these titanic gods. And we see how helpless the people are in the face of this strange and bizarre technology. And it is quite spectacular. They get out of the water at some point. Again, there's another wonderful, uncanny scene where clothing just kind of from out of the sky, clothing just drops down, ostensibly maybe from some high-flying, you know, jet that the aliens have destroyed. Then there's this moment where the National Guard is battling the aliens on the crest of this hill. And what we see is the hill. We don't see what's going on behind it, but we see lots of lights and flashings and wonderful Spielbergian off-screen glory. Robbie runs away. He wants to get to the fighting. Ray leaves his daughter and runs after Robbie. Then a young couple picks up Rachel and they carry her away. And he has to choose between letting Robbie go and getting to... The whole thing is just melodramatic. Nobody cares what happens to these people. However, the shots of the helicopters and the National Guard as they enter the scene and they loose their rockets and their bombs and their machine guns at these aliens, which we do not see. And they're just falling back. We see them exploding. Tanks come back the other way on fire, you know, and it's just this wonderful unknown menace. I mean, yes, we've seen them. And, you know, a lesser filmmaker would have overdone it by staging a huge battle between the tripods and the National Guard. But I think Spielberg is very smart and he knows that we get saturated quickly with spectacle and you have to be careful. You have to be judicious about how much spectacle you lav on an audience. But the plot involves some contact with the alien and ingeniously this is how he stages it. Everything's off screen and it's marvelous. A couple of brief moments here. We do see some aliens and as we see some of the missiles, you know, they're detonating against the shields and for the first time we get to see the alien shields sort of activate as the missiles come in contact with them, harkening back to the original film, which did something very similar. So before I cut back to the original film, at the risk of being redundant, I want to talk about the family, the Ferriers in this film. And I just want to talk about the use of their relationship and what he's trying to do. In the original film, you get characters who are in opposition to the aliens themselves. You know, they are unitedly faced out towards the aliens. What they do makes sense. They are concerned with their safety and the threat of the aliens. I think what the writers were trying to do here is to just bring the tension up to 110. As our films and our media continues to get what Marshall McLuhan used to call hot media being media that you just sit back and it dazzles you and lights you up versus cool media, which some part of you must emerge and engage with it like a book. As media continues into the, you know, the heat stratosphere, more and more seemingly must be done to charge the audience, make the audience just sit up and dazzle them at every moment. And so I feel what's going on here is you are never allowed to rest as a viewer. I'm assuming that this is the director and the writer's purpose. They sat down around a table and said, I want this to be, if there are any breaks in tension, I want it to be too short. I want the audience on the edge of their seats during most of this film. How can we do that? From what I'm seeing on screen, they decided that the tension and the unsettledness that we feel comes as much from the family and the human, you know, actors as it comes from the aliens. To me, I can't imagine that it was not designed this way. Because it was designed that way, it's not an organic, no one cares about these characters. There's no hero's journey here. And not that there ever has to be, I want to put that clear, but there's no journey at all. You know, this is Ray Ferrier. Can he step up and be a good dad and bring his kids to Boston? And nobody cares. None of these characters matter in a sense that they are put in this situation to annoy the piss out of us so that we get tension from the aliens and the completely unstable nature of the human actors as well. I just think it's a very cynical use of characters and emotional relationships. I don't think the writer in any way has any stake in Ray Ferrier's relationship with his daughter or his son, or Robbie's relationship with Rachel, and vice versa. I think it is a very cynical use of the family triangle in this case to elicit scares and anxiety and just a sense of being unsettled. And that's what bothers me mostly about this film. The character's journey, the story, we're not allowed to have characters and story that just exist to be in the story. They must now serve some purpose to keep us more and more unsettled. And there's more to come. You know, one of the things that will happen later on with another character is the closest that I can possibly come to thinking that this was clever. If it had been a solitary incident, I think it might have worked really well. There was a similar incident in the novel. For the most part, and I'll end here, I do not like the cynical use of characters and emotional relationships to simply jolt an audience. And in my perspective, this is what I've seen here. And I haven't seen anything to make me believe otherwise. So, end spiel. Now, let's talk about a scene that's shared by both films. And this is what I call the house attack scene. In short, it's when the major characters in the film are stuck inside of a house and the aliens are sort of probing the house to find out if they're in fact in there. I want to kind of talk about how each film approaches it. We'll start with the 1953 film. After the plane crash, Clayton and Sylvia have found this abandoned farmhouse. Clayton is watching Sylvia sleep, and, you know, from the soft lighting and music, we believe he's falling in love with her. Sylvia cooks breakfast in the morning, and they start talking about themselves a little bit, and we hear Clayton say that, you know, he's an orphan. He has no family, and something that he has missed all his life. And of course, Sylvia comes from a big family, and it just seems fine. You know, I don't feel manipulated here. I just feel like Clayton, kind of the loner scientist, the orphan. Yeah, it makes sense. Sylvia being, you know, domestic oriented, right, and very centered, coming from a large family. Yeah, that makes sense. It's nice because it's not done to excessive effect. You know, Sylvia does break down at one point because of her sense of fear being away from the family, you know, that she's having kind of trouble not being connected to them, and it's frightening her, and she cries, and it's right, you know, it all feels right. It's not Shakespeare, right, or amazing drama, but it fits to the characters. Suddenly, one of the alien cylinders crashes right into the farmhouse. Kind of nice miniature work by the special effects team. So the aliens are directly outside the farmhouse, and Clayton and Sylvia are hiding inside. We hear a lot of sounds and lights, and we see lights outside, but we don't know what's going on, and neither do the characters. You know, we, the audience, know as much as the main characters do. So now we have the entrance of this long tethered probe coming into the farmhouse, and the probe looks exactly like the sort of Hoover vacuum cleaner head that we've seen on most of these manta ray shapes. Actually, it's funny. The face reminded me of the game Simon, but with only three colors. Nothing much happens. It's very quiet. It enters. There's this money shot of all money shots that I think is the best shot in this film. Sylvia's looking out the window away from the probe, and we get a glimpse of a full-size alien moving between the two buildings. And I mean, it happens in 2 seconds. It's enough time where it's such a startling scene. You know, I would imagine that audiences back then really freaked out. Because even today, I kind of freak out a little bit when it happens. It's a masterful little shot. It's amazing that Spielberg didn't steal it. And I'm wondering if he just felt a sense of homage that he wasn't going to touch that shot. M. Night Shyamalan stole it shamelessly for the movie Signs. In Signs, it's the scene where they're watching the first video of the aliens that's seen. I don't remember the movie very well, but I do remember there is a scene of an alien, you know, just going between two buildings very fast, and it's right from this film. It's a very creepy scene. Sylvia and Clayton come to discover that the aliens now have sort of blocked in the house purposefully, they think. The probe now comes in. The shot is basically on Sylvia, and then she turns around, and the probe is right there, right in her face, and she screams. Clayton grabs an axe and chops the head of the probe off, and the cable retracts out, but the head of the probe is still there. Then Sylvia turns back around and Clayton's consoling her, and this creepy long arm with a three-fingered hand reaches up and puts its hand on Sylvia's shoulder, and for a second she doesn't say anything and she turns and she screams. It's another creepy scene. There's a shadow tracking up to her before that scene too, so the audience member, we know something's about to happen. Once she turns and screams, we get a sense of some four-foot alien with eyes very similar to the probe's eyes, and it's slightly shadowed. Clayton brings a light around, and the thing puts both hands in front of its face. Clayton throws something at it. It screeches, hurt, and then it runs away. It's an amazing moment. I mean, it still works. It really still works. The whole house scene in this initial film is terrific. You know, unfortunately, Sylvia completely breaks down. You know, we're in our back in our pre-feminist era. And, of course, Clayton is consoling her. And then the pair finally, they get out of the farmhouse just as the aliens finally destroy it. It's an amazing scene. Now to the remake. We've got pretty much a retread of the first film with some differences. The difference here is that when our heroes are running away from the battle where they lost Robbie, when Robbie finally leaves to go over the hill to fight with the National Guard, there's this huge explosion. So as audience members, we think Robbie's bought it. Yay. So they're running away from this, and they're running by a house with a lot of other refugees, and we see a figure emerge from a basement holding a rifle. Ray runs over, and they duck down into the house, and we meet Tim Robbins. The character's name is Harlan Ogilvie, and I like to think that Harlan perhaps comes from science fiction writer Harlan Ellison, and Ogilvie is the name of the character in the novel. So it's a little Easter eggs, as they like to say. We're ratcheting up the tension. It's not just two people stuck in a house now. We've got three people in a house. We get the sense now that Tim Robbins is pretty much nuts. He's lost his entire family. He's really, really gearing up. He wants to fight the aliens with his shotgun. He's got this whole notion that, you know, the human race is going to rise up from underground. We'll be the ones to rise up and fight. We're setting him up for his villain role. He hasn't, right now, and to Robbins' credit, right now he's very sympathetic. He shares a drink with Ray when his daughter goes to sleep. This is very similar to the sequence in the novel where the main character is shacked up with a priest, I believe called the Curate. Another thing they pulled from the book, which was not dealt with in the first film, was the red vines. From Ray's point of view, as he watches these vines propagate through the basement window and kind of down the wall, and they're growing pretty quickly. And so we just get a quick look at them, and we don't really get into exactly what they are yet. However, now the alien probe comes in, and this one, of course, is completely CGI, but it looks great. I mean, it really looks amazing, and it moves very cool. So now there's tension in the basement, and we get another Spielbergian master moment. The camera is focused in on a spider web, which is sort of rhythmically moving to some air current, and the camera pans over, and it's Rachel breathing with fright. I mean, tactile detail up the wazoo, as they say. This is what Spielberg does best. He does it so well. Then we get our human tension as Ogilvie grabs an axe and he wants to, like the original movie, cut the head off the probe. Ray is there silently entreating him to not do it. Eventually, Ogilvie stands down and the probe withdraws. The next tension-filled scene now comes just after we get our first real look at our aliens, and they look just like the tripods, which is kind of neat. There are three of them, all CGI, and they come into the basement and they're looking at books and spinning wheels of bicycles. And they're large-eyed, sort of raptor size, if you will, and very creepy. Large eyes. They don't look evil, which I like. They just look really creepy and strange. Their large eyes are kind of very E.T.-like. The tension is ratcheted up as Ogilvie grabs his rifle and he's ready to fire because he wants to kill one. Ogilvie and Ray are fighting silently with Ogilvie's shotgun. Ray's trying to take it from Ogilvie. And it's a good scene. And this is where I said earlier that this is one sequence which makes sense to me that, you know, Ogilvie's crazy. And the fact that these two are struggling in silence, neither one of them wants really to give their position away to the aliens. But Ogilvie wants his gun and Ray wants it as well. And it's really good. You know, Dakota Fanning is off to the side, just terrified as she is in this whole film. And then the tension is broken when we hear one of the aliens from outside hoot its song and the three aliens sort of drop everything and leave. Then we're back to the red roots. Ray is looking outside at this red mist that's coming in the window and he puts his hand up and we can see the mist on his hands and it looks like blood. We're not really sure what it is, but we see the aliens are spraying the mist everywhere and the vines are propagating at an alarming rate. Ogilvie then finally yells to Ray, and Ray runs over, and Ogilvie is, like, freaked out. And he points, and he shows Ray where the mist is, how it's being generated. And the aliens are taking humans from the little baskets, putting them down on the ground, and some large spike is being inserted in them and their blood is being drained. And I'm assuming it's being mixed with some kind of alien DNA and they're spraying it around, sort of creating a new biosphere. And it's taken from the novel. In the novel, the aliens were sort of blood drinkers as well, the Martians. And the red vines were from the novel. So it's cool, man. And the vines are growing and it's really creepy. But Ogilvy's lost his shit and he wants to now kill them. Basically go into another room and he kills Ogilvy because of he was about to give their position away for good. And he knows Ogilvy's kind of lost his mind. I respected that they made, finally, Ray had to make a hard choice and actually kill someone. In the way that they did it, it was great. But because I have not felt the writers have been dealing honest with me up till this point, it didn't really matter to me, you know? It should have been much more of a devastating thing, I thought, in a sense of having humans having to band together against the aliens and this having to happen, this tragedy of one human having to kill another. I didn't really care. Even though while I respected the choice of the writers to put it in the movie, I thought it was kind of too late. And at that point, just as he's killed Ogilvy, the probe comes back, discovers them, and like in the first film, Ray has to hack the head off of it. He leaves Rachel in the basement, and Ray runs out and leaves the house, and there's this great scene of like red vine apocalypse. Very creepy landscape scene where the red vines are really propagating now. And now it's Ray versus the tripod. The tripod's trying to take Ray, and Ray hides out in a car. The tripod flips the car over, and Ray kind of hides. The tripod thinks that he's dead. But then we see Rachel gets captured, of course. Ray first grabbing a bandolier of hand grenades from a nearby truck, I believe, gets himself taken as well so he can be in the same cage as Rachel. So now Ray is prisoner and being taken into one of the baskets in the aliens. So now a comparison between the two scenes. I feel like the original really, really trumps the remake here. The brief scene of the alien trumps everything that's happened in the remake. It's an amazing moment. The alien putting the paw on Sylvia's shoulder, the brief reveal, the shadows even used are very effective. It's very good suspense, and it is not dated to me. And we don't linger long on the aliens at all. I think the remake's version is a little less effective because it tries to stack the deck, you know, upping the ante on the conflict. We see more of the aliens. In a sense, even when the probe was in, I didn't feel like a ton of suspense. I think what the original did, the remake really tried to up the ante with Ogilvy and the vines and the blood and the really long shots of the three aliens. I didn't think it did as good a job as the original did. So now we get into what I call the post-house plots. After the house scenes in both films, what happened next? And we're going to start with the 1953 film. So we start with a voiceover narration, which is giving us the world situation, which is not good. And this is the main difference between the new version and the old. In the new one, we are near the sort of centers of power and knowledge. Spielberg version, obviously, it's man on the street. From the footage that we're given for around the world, I kind of get a sense that a lot of it's World War II footage. It was taken from, you know, a lot of the German cities that the Allies had destroyed. So we had a lot of footage of those. So now we see General Mann, who's the main general, and he's showing us on a blackboard how the Martians take territory and how they do it in a three-vehicle formation. It's kind of cool, you know, not a necessary detail, but an interesting detail of how they begin to stake out territory and how they eradicate everything in it. The government is now convinced that, you know, nothing is working and it's time for the A-bomb. Then we cut to Clayton and Sylvia, and they finally get to the Pacific Institute. And he's carrying the head of the sort of eyepiece of the head of this, you know, vacuum cleaner looking thing that had been sneaking up on them in the house. So they start talking right away about how they might re-engineer it to learn about how the Martians see. And there was some blood on it. So they test the blood and the blood is anemic. So, you know, there's another vector to look at. They actually hook up the Martian eye to a TV screen and turn it on. In a funny little turn of the screw, the Martians see us as all green-faced. You know, when we were in the midst of the green aliens and Martians that this was used. So very tongue-in-cheek, very clever. The bomb is going to be delivered by this giant flying wing. And actually, this was very current. They were using actual footage of the Northrop YB-49 flying wing, which was cutting-edge at the time. And so you see actual footage of the YB-49 flying. They're all waiting now for the bomb to be delivered, see if it's going to work. Someone mentions that if the bomb doesn't work, 6 days later, the Earth is done for, And Sylvia mentions that it was interesting that it took 6 days to create and that the aliens will destroy it in six. So again, spiritual faith matters, always very close in this film, never far away. You know, they're doing both. And I think because of the use of that, it saves the ending. Because, you know, the novelistic ending and the way this story, I should say, ends is very anticlimactic in terms of storytelling. So I think the way they use religion in it actually makes for good storytelling, as we will see going forward. Of course, there's some great suspense, this swirling fog, the bomb is dropped, the aliens emerge from the fog completely undamaged. The scientists at Pacific Tech decide they're going to take all these instruments and the pieces of the alien and they're going to head for the mountains to try to figure out some weakness, but Los Angeles is lost, and probably most of humankind, which is pretty wild. Now we'll switch to briefly to the 2005 film, and the post-house sequence, if you recall, Ray is now inside the alien vessel with his daughter, Rachel, and in one of those baskets that we had seen before, and I believe this was definitely taken from the novel, the whole blood thing. Every once in a while, a tentacle comes into the basket, grabs someone, pulls them through a sort of sphincter-like opening, and they're taken out. And we know from what we've seen before that they are drained of blood, and the blood is used somehow to create these vines, these creepy-looking red vines. Of course, at one point, Ray gets taken, and when Ray gets taken, he grabs the hand grenades that he had taken when he got brought into the basket. And then we get this little sense of 9/11 positivity, because when Ray goes in to the alien, you know, the belly of the alien, he's held by first a soldier, and then the soldier is held by a civilian. So there's sort of a chain of human beings holding Ray, so Ray doesn't get lost in this thing, which I thought was just a nice metaphor in terms of, you know, the solidarity as people band together, as they did very much after 9/11. Finally, Ray is pulled out, and he spits out the pins in all the grenades, which then explode, destroying the tripod from within and saving the people in both baskets. So to compare the two, briefly, post-house scenes, the original actually has a plot and a story and is setting up the third act. They talk about a plan to move the lab into the mountains, and it gives us the next step, a reason for them to evacuate Los Angeles with a truck full of instruments. And the suspense for the audience is, you know, will the Pacific Tech scientists make it out of Los Angeles before the aliens destroy it? Solid storytelling. The remake, I don't know what it's trying to do. It's just, you know, has time on its hands, and it's just trying to work us on sheer suspense. Ray is after his daughter. He's got to rescue his daughter. It's a very visceral scene, of course, but the remake is now a shapeless movie, pretty much, and will continue to be shapeless. You know, the decision to film the remake inside the fog of war is wonderful for certain things, but at a certain point, it makes it harder and harder to keep a real story going. Like I said earlier, the whole plot is Ray going to Boston, you know. Dude, take an Amtrak. Who fucking cares? So now we shift to the end game, the final act in first both films, and I'll start with the 1953 film. So we're in Los Angeles, and there's actual footage of L.A. as it evacuates. Lots of shots of cars and traffic and buses, and we see the mass evacuation of Los Angeles. It's really, really well shot. Seems quasi-documentary, like it looks really good. A lot of the shots are back far enough, so you realize they've, you know, a couple of blocks of city have been used to film this film. And it looks good, you know. I'm in the movie very much right now with them. As they're leaving Pacific Tech, Sylvia and the rest of the scientists go in this bus that she drives. That's kind of cool, right? She's in the driver's seat. And they leave, and then Clayton is left with the truck full of instruments. And what I like about the original film is that right at this moment, LA is pretty much evacuated. I mean, the streets are empty, and it's very eerie. The aliens haven't got there yet. And Clayton's just driving down the L.A. thoroughfares, completely deserted. I mean, it looks great. You know, it really looks great. He runs into mobs of people stealing vehicles, of course. And this was taken by the remake, which used it a little earlier in their sequence of events. He runs into the mob, and he's dragged out of the truck and beaten up, and his truck is stolen. It's complete anarchy in the city at this point. He tries to get the cops to help him. People are throwing instruments out of the truck, and he gets punched. And, you know, right there, like, I'm in the story. I'm like, you know, there's a reason this guy needs to get out of the city. It's not that, you know, he needs to go visit his wife in Boston. Like, these instruments may well be the only thing that stands between complete domination of the planet and us figuring out what the hell we can do to fight them. So there's real stakes here. So then everyone's gone. Clayton's by himself. Now he's running through the streets looking for Sylvia, looking for the truck, looking for anything. And comes upon the truck. It's completely destroyed. And he sees some detritus that came from the school bus. And he realizes that Sylvia may not have made it out. So then we cut to some large-scale destruction as the Martians enter Los Angeles. And it's good. It's solid. You know, I mean, it could be Godzilla, but it's aliens. And it's really solid. They come in the city and they're destroying chunks of buildings and entire blocks. And two military police in a van try to pick up Clayton, but he waves them off because now he knows sort of where Sylvia is, because at one point earlier on when they're in the house, she talks about, you know, churches being safe places, and that sets up, you know, the third act in the film. And he hears singing. He runs into the church. The city is completely in flames now, and, you know, as he runs into a church, there's a bit about this pastor asking for divine intervention. You know, the city's in flames. Sylvia's not there. And he runs out of the church to another one. And the Martians continually destroying Los Angeles, taking their time, very stately, moving down the streets, blowing things up, leveling buildings. Clayton gets into another church. A woman translates into Spanish what he's saying. Sylvia's not there. He's back out. Finally, you know, amidst the Martians, you know, several blocks away, he gets into a church and he finds Sylvia. And, you know, there's this great moment of they push through the packed masses of the church and they come together and they're holding each other. And this is it. And everyone's in the church praying, and it's the end game. And this is shaped well. We have Sylvia and Clayton in this church. We're rooting for them. We want them to live. We want something good to happen. They're praying. They're in a church. They're praying for some divine intervention. This is a way of us having stakes. You know, are the Martians going to destroy this church too? And kill our heroes. Like, it matters. It's a big difference in the two endings, as we'll get to with this, the remake. Then out on the street, we see the first signs, like half a block away from the church, first signs come that a Martian vessel is malfunctioning. And one of the ships crashes out and dies next to a building. The people come out. All of a sudden, all the sounds stop. Everything gets quiet in the church, and they run outside, and they, you know, they go up to the ship. And it's a really nice shot of the people in the foreground, ship in the background, you know. There's this classic scene of the a hatch opening under the ship, and this three, you know, the arm we'd seen on Sylvia's shoulder before comes kind of crawling out of this little hatch and dies. There's a quick shot from inside the ship, kind of pointed towards the townspeople as they approach the ship, which is kind of cool. In that moment, another ship crashes nearby and we realize the Martians are dying. And then from there, the voiceover takes us and he talks about, and this is the ending in the novel as well, that the minute the Martians breathe the air of the Earth, that millions of bacteria were going to work on their bodies. The great ending of both movies, actually, is, and this is great notion of, you know, we've earned our immunity by the death of billions. And there's a great line, because Wells is a really good writer, men do not live or die in vain, or men do not die in vain, something to that effect. And it's, take it as you will, faith-based or not, like, it's a great line. Like, we've earned, you know, we live amongst something that was completely deadly to this species that arrived here. That they could not measure with any of their instruments, could not understand. It was completely beyond them. You know, but that humanity had earned our immunity by billions of deaths, and that we do not die in vain. Something there that I like. So that ends the act three of the original. Now, the last act of the remake, we cut to large groups of refugees moving into Boston, and everyone is very cold and exhausted. You know, from Ray's point of view, he notices that birds are feasting on the red vines. This main statue of a Minuteman, I would assume, or some Revolutionary War statue that's full of vines, but the vines are all brown and rotting away. And say it as you will, right? Boston, the American Revolution, it's all there. It's all there. Now we see some wonderful Spielbergian magic, the last bit before the end of the film. As some of the groups of people are walking now into the city, from a low angle, we see a dead tripod that's already crashed into a building. From this low angle, it's just, you know, Steadicam. It looks amazing. It looks very real, you know, just there's so much naturalism. And then all of a sudden, that same naturalism is there plus the tripod, and it's awesome. And now we see a tripod operating nearby, but it's weird. It's erratic. It sounds strange. We don't get that same sound. And so the National Guard and the soldiers that are escorting the civilians sort of get themselves in place. Now, you know, the alien's hooting its large sound. And Ray is the one that notices that birds are perched actually on the tripod. And, of course, he intuits that the shield has collapsed and tells the soldier that. And, of course, our hero, Ray, tells the National Guard to bazooka down an alien that probably would have died, you know, 10 minutes later. But it's a cool scene as the missiles impact on the alien with no shield, and it falls crashing into a real building, which was probably demolished. And it's fairly seamless, so it looks very realistic. Everyone gathers round, just like the first film. The hatch opens and an arm drops down, homage to the first film. And also more of the arm, we see the head of the alien. And in this last scene, something happens to the alien over the space of a few seconds where it sort of solidifies and gets brown, obviously dead from the same danger, the bacteria. Ray now is walking down a deserted Boston street. A door opens. We see his ex-wife. Rachel runs out of Ray's arms and his ex-wife runs out of the door, and we have the classic, you know, loved ones running together, which I am sure filmmakers have gone into psychologists' office and figured out why this scene is emotionally powerful in every stupid movie ever imaginable. But there's no denying a woman, you know, a mother separated from her offspring, some swelling music and some running. It could be the worst movie in the world, and it does something. It's fascinating. Anyway, not to much avail here. It's a cheap win, as it were. And then we see, of course, Robbie appears behind two people who we see as the grandparents of the house that they're staying at, which to me is completely absurd, but there it is. A brief aside, the grandparents in the remake are actually the two actors who played Clayton and Sylvia in the original film. Gene Barry and Anne Robinson play Ray's ex-wife's mother and father. So that was cute. And that is it. We come to the end of the remake. So just to compare the final acts, to me, the shape of the original film is so far superior here. I mean, Clayton has a real reason to leave the city, and the scene of having his truck taken from him versus when, you know, the Ferriers had their car taken from them, there's no comparison. It has real impact. Our terrified mob versus the thinkers and scientists who actually could have done something. So the remake ending has no shape to me, really. They walk into Boston and some military guys destroy the aliens that are already dying, you know, but Ray's the one who notices that, you know, the shield's down. It's a really shapeless ending. We come from our hero and heroine huddling in a church about to be destroyed to this. It's the original structure to me is just superior. And because it's more of a classically structured film, it may not hit the highs that this film has hit, but it doesn't hit the lows. And, you know, at the end of the day, it just holds together as a film better. Let me give some final thoughts on this show of the remake versus the original. You know, I like to think that in some ways, the original was made in 1953. We were in the midst of the atomic age, and atomic annihilation was at the forefront of a lot of thinking and a lot of life. Nuclear Armageddon was not some abstract thing like it is now. It was a real fear. In terms of how it feeds into the original, I would say just, you know, the use of the atomic bomb, that even this weapon had no effect on the aliens, and that yet at the end of the day, the natural world is what really destroyed them. Although it wasn't an eco-minded movie, kind of prescient in its way. And obviously the remake, you know, this is the age of terrorism. We're living in it right now. We're not at the top, at the command structure like we are in the original. You know, we're with the regular folks. The camera itself is even lots of shots from low angle. I'd like to think that the filmmakers were very much aware of this in terms of it being about terrorists and people. You know, it was like the low striking down the high, but who suffered but, you know, the low as well. I mean, regular folks died by a non-state actors, as they're called. As far as shape goes, the original has a real shape. There's a real through line. A scientist fleeing an alien invasion is able to take a piece of the technology to his team, recognizing that they cannot beat the aliens by modern military tech. So on and so forth. You know, this makes sense to me, and it gives the film a real plot. The remake's plot of having Ray take his kids to Boston really makes this film sort of weightless. Although the cinematic technique of Spielberg and of 21st century filmmaking is formidable, and by the end of the film you have been dazzled, it's empty calories. Unfortunately, it is purely empty calories. The original tries to bring in religion in a respectful way, I believe, and science in a respectful way. The pastor is a very courageous man, and he wants to espouse nonviolence, sacrifices his life, doesn't ask anyone to do it for him, does it himself. In terms of how religion impacts Sylvia, I mean, Sylvia is very, you know, is very faithful, and she goes to hide in a church. And in a sense, because Clayton knows that, he finds her in a church. And there's something about that that I like, about her faith, you know, draws Clayton, and it kind of helps them connect in for real. And yet, you know, there's a real respect for science in the original. You know, we talk about magnetism, we talk about optics, we're talking about a little bit about blood, bacteria. I mean, it's very much in there. We have a tour of the solar system. There's a thematic solidity to things in the original that I think is absent in the remake. You know, when the ending narration is read in the remake, it's like, oh, whatever. I guess, you know, the alien's lost. And there's at least thematic material in the first film that leads you to that in terms of science and faith and, you know, what happens. And in the remake, it's just like they're tacking it on. I will say that in terms of movie making, where we are now, you know, the new film tries to, we have these forms of dramatic development, right? And even though they are forms, the new film really treats them purely as forms. They really have no content. The character development of Ray and his family, as I've stated earlier, to me, is very cynical and very manipulative. And I don't think it's any better than, you know, the stock hero and heroine of the first film. You know, we haven't come any further. You know, they were just a little more honest about what these people were. And in the new film, I think the filmmakers were a little more cynical about manipulating the audience into thinking we were watching people who have real relationships, but they were simply there to tweak the audience's, you know, comfort level. There are scenes between Ray and his son and daughter that belong in a real TV melodrama. And I don't think the audience really buys it very much. How they talk over each other, you know, techniques from possibly from plays and from films, like, oh, they're talking over each other. What realistic dialogue? It's like, it's showy technique that's just, again, to my mind, doesn't belong in this movie. I mean, there's an honesty about the first film that knows that it's about aliens and the destruction of aliens that focuses on that. And it shows the human drama where it can. It's not trying to do everything. You know, the reboot wants it both ways. It wants to have the realistic family drama up against this alien invasion film. And admirable as it may be, it just, you can't have both. It doesn't work. I think, you know, you try to have both and neither works completely. That said, as I'm kind of, you know, I'm siding a little bit here with the original film, the images that are on this screen on the remake are some of the most memorable science fiction images. And to me, in sci-fi film history, Spielberg, to me, as a pure visualist designing action scenes, is in peak form. Peak form. Again and again and again, we are treated to the uncanny, the incredibly detailed, to the spectacular. His direction is masterful. He masters the tiny and the giant in this film in such a way that, you know, as a cinematic experience, you're put through the ringer often in this film. I think at the end of the film, it pales, unfortunately. I mean, the original film is probably a better package overall, more solidly built dramatically. The experience of the set pieces in this remake are just unbelievable. And to see them in a theater, you know, with full digital sound, it is a cinematic experience. And frankly, I think that's what Spielberg's all about. I mean, I think that's where he excels. I mean, to my mind, he's a very talented visual storyteller. And he's, you know, he's as good as the script that he's given. But his technique is astonishing, truly astonishing. But by the end of the remake, I have been poisoned by the shapeless end of this film, the shapeless third of it. I mean, you could probably argue the whole film had no shape, but, you know, there was some through line in the beginning. And at the end of the film, I just was sort of like, it was really cotton candy. The end of the War of the Worlds, the first one, I mean, you know, it's not the greatest of films, but I don't know. It had a little more stock to it, as it were. So obviously, I'm not going to come down on one to the other because it's separated too far in time, I think, that you can do that. So with that, we're going to end this episode of Sci-Fi on Screen, War of the Worlds Comparison. You can find us online at scifionscreen.com. We are also on iTunes. Sci-Fi on Screen. We would love some feedback or comments. We have a Facebook page. You can search for us on Facebook as well on Sci-Fi on Screen. If you're interested in emailing, you can also email us at scifionscreen@gmail.com. So look forward to any feedback you may have. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I had a lot of fun making it. And I'll see you next time.